This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you once again. And as always, you're listening to the show live throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, or you're tuned in to our free live streaming or the archived podcast of the program, and you're doing that on our HRN website at horseracingradio.net. Well, you know, on last week's show, I spent an hour visiting with Rodeo Hall of Famer Sean Davis. And Sean made his mark as a world champion saddle bronc rider before turning his attention to training racehorses. Today's guest is also no stranger to the rodeo arena, a former bull rider. He began his training career with thoroughbreds anyways in 1995 and has had significant success saddling 2,457 winners to date, with purse earnings totaling nearly $38 million. Please join me in welcoming the 54-year-old native of Yoakum, Texas, Danny Pish, to Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Danny, appreciate the visit, my friend. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Well, good morning and glad to be with you.
Yeah, looking forward to hearing your story. You know, I mentioned the rodeo angle, and the visit I had last week for an hour with Sean Davis was one of the most special shows I've ever done. There's something about people that come from that side of the ledger, if you will, from the rodeo side to training thoroughbreds, that's just really, really special.
You know, it really appears that way, that the guys that come from the rodeo world, when they set their mind to do the thoroughbreds, they or quarter horses, either one, they do well. And Sean is what an individual that guy is, and what a life he's had. My goodness.
Yeah, incredible. To hear him tell stories about, you know, dining on the White House lawn with President Reagan and then talking about the National Finals Rodeo and everything he did with that organization, it was really remarkable. And I know that you might not have reached those heights necessarily, but you had a pretty good career as a rodeo rider too.
You know, I did okay. I really, basically, in my rodeo world, life was very similar to my racetrack life. Is that I really, really raked in on the second tier, and I didn't spend much time at the top tier, but on my few cameo appearances, I certainly didn't embarrass anyone, and it's just really a mirror image of what my race career has been.
When you first, as a kid, and you started thinking about what you wanted to do in life, was rodeo number one, and then maybe horses number two, or were horses way out there in the distance?
Well, horses were in the distance a bit. It went like this. My first dream, starting far back as I can remember, was to be, I wanted to follow in Walt Garrison's footsteps. I wanted to be a professional rodeo cowboy as well as an NFL player.
Oh, wow.
I had a lot of hustle on the football field, but not near the talent necessary to do. So that became pretty evident by the end of my eighth grade football career. And so then, yeah, I went in and played football one more year as a freshman, and I knew that I wasn't going to excel at it. I still loved the game, but I knew I wasn't going to excel at it, and I was already beginning to have some success rodeoing. So I've turned my focus more so on rodeo. And just prior to that, the racehorses came into my radar. My father... we used to go to an old unrecognized quarter horse track in Goliad and buy some of their 2-year-olds that just weren't cutting it, and we would retrain them, re-break them, and sell them to the rodeo guys. And so that was my first, and I got some jobs breaking race colts, quarter horse race colts for some of those guys over there. when I was in junior high, got those jobs going for them. And so I began to see that there was a large number of horses in this race industry. And then there was a Triple Crown big-time rivalry, or whatever you want to call it, with Affirmed and Aladar. And I go, you know what? I'm going to do the racehorses someday, and that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do those thoroughbreds. And I never really investigated or did much again, but I remember making that decision. And then much later in life, after lots of years of breaking lots of colts and whatnot, and rodeoing for many years, I think I was 29 when I decided, well, you know, the bull riding deal is about done. And, you know, let me take an extra hard look at this thoroughbred world. And, you know, I'd broke lots of thoroughbred colts and had some exposure to it and whatnot. But I was 29 years old before I really said, okay, this goes on the front plate and the rodeo goes on the back burner. And I've got to delve into this this thoroughbred horse racing, because I thought maybe, and now I know, this is what I want to do.
You know, I can tell you one of my favorite events to watch when I watch the rodeo on television is the bull riding. And I think that, you know, the bull riders that compete in that event are such great athletes. And I've said the same thing about jockeys for many, many years. I think that they're pound for pound as good an athlete as we have in the world of sports today. When you were working with the quarter horses and then also doing some rodeo and riding bulls, what would you say was more challenging? Was it more challenging to work with those young quarter horses and get them broke, or was it more challenging to hop on the back of a bull?
Definitely more challenging to try to ride bulls. that was always it. Was all, no matter how, the thing about bull riding is, no matter how competent you are, everyone is. I mean, it's there's no gimmies. I mean, there's no gimmies in anything in life, but there is especially no gimmies in the bull riding world.
Who was the toughest bull you ever rode?
I rode several different national finals bulls. Saturday Night Live was a bull that was considered an eliminator that made a few trips to the national finals, and he was probably the most feared bull I rode. The most famous bull I rode was Big Ben Coors, and Big Ben Coors was he went to the National Finals Rodeo years ago before all 10 rounds were televised, and he was in the 10th round like 5 years in a row, which the cream of the cream is in the last round of the NFR, and he was in, and that's very few bulls have that, can say that on their resume. Very few, maybe 12 or 15. In the history of rodeo could say they were in the last round. Used to be called the TV round because the 10th round was the only round they televised back then. But anyway, he was, made like 5 appearances in that round. I rode him as well, and he was the most famous, and Saturday Night Live was probably the most feared.
Did you stay on the whole time?
Those two, yeah. I wouldn't have brought those two up if I had not. Now, I will tell you about one buck off. I did get on, on a sad note, the bull that injured Lane Frost, which cost him his life in the arena in Cheyenne. I drew that bull about 6 weeks later after Lane had passed away, and that was a nerve-wracking experience.
Oh, I can imagine.
But I did not quite make the whistle on him. I'm proud to say I went at him full force, no hesitation. But didn't quite make the whistle.
When I talk to jockeys, a lot of times they'll tell me that going into any race, not just a big race, but any race, they'll have a plan A, a plan B, and a plan C in their head. And then when the gates open, they might have to go immediately to plan D because everything changes. Is it like that with a bull rider too?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You really, the more a guy rides, you know, experience is wonderful. But you have to play jump for jump. You know, you can't take nothing for granted. And so I think that a jockey has to do something very similar. I call it teetering between subconscious and conscious. You know, and I think every professional athlete does that. Is you know, the really, really good ones. And when I was doing my best riding, I was able to do just that, which is, you know, you leave there in your subconscious just telling yourself, don't make no plans, riding jump for jump. But then when he begins to do the same old pattern that he's known for, you might need to use that, you know, so you have to kind of, you can't let your conscious mind let you get ahead of yourself, because they will change their plans. They will feel you doing that, and they'll do something different. And so you can't get ahead of them just because of what they're supposed to do. So you've got to be in your subconscious. But with some of them, they're just so challenging. You need that knowledge of what may happen next, and it can help you.
What ride are you most proud of when you think back on that rodeo career?
You know, actually, the ride I'm probably most proud of was at an event called the World's Largest Bull Riding in Ardmore, Oklahoma. I actually finished second in the event. Tuff Hedeman won the event on a bull that was the IRA Bucking Bull of the Year the year before, and he belonged to a gentleman named Larry Kephart. Now, that was an association I didn't compete in much, and I'm straining to remember that bull's. He didn't have a name. All he had was a brand number. It was like 22 or 33 or something like that. But anyway, he'd been bucking bull the years in the IRA. He hadn't been ridden in a year since the year before when Lane Frost rode him at the World's Largest Bull Riding there in Ardmore. And that was probably the ride I was most proud of, because he really, really bucked. And I felt like, you know, you couldn't have shot me off of him. I just felt like I owned him from jump one. And not every ride feels like that.
Visiting with trainer Danny Pish here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Danny, what things did you take away from your time riding bulls, your time at the rodeo, that maybe even helped you as you started to transition into working with horses?
Well, just a lifetime of being around livestock, much of that at the rodeos, and competing, as well as helping produce and put on the rodeos. I helped stock contractors and producers as well. And so, you know, putting on the whole show and dealing with the livestock was a big advantage. And honestly, I've said it many times, is that to me, I've been around an enormous different number of disciplines of horsemanship. My grandfather was a saddle maker. My father was also a saddle maker and worked for one of the largest saddleries in the world. And he sometimes went and would go to a certain discipline, cutting or rein cow horse or barrel racer, you know, calf roper, and get a commercial endorsement from these guys, you know, to make tack with their name on it. So I also got exposed to so many different equine athletes and bovine athletes. It just helped me read livestock. And what I have said so many times is the closest discipline to racehorses is bucking stock. The bucking bulls and the bucking horses is the closest discipline there is. Because while you do train them a certain amount, they have to have that instinct. They have to have that God-given physical talent and that God-given instinct to compete. You can enhance that instinct or you can dull it down. You can enhance the physical strength or you can compromise the physical strength. So what you start with, you can enhance or compromise, but you have to have certain things that are just what I call God-given gifts. And if that individual doesn't have it, you're never going to have any success. And they just have to have a large amount of their own want to. And I've always said that of all the different disciplines I've been around, I think that bucking stock is actually the closest to race stock. I can give you a good example of why.
It's very, very interesting. And, you know, when you think about your reputation, one thing you're known for, Danny, is being very good with your young horses, your two-year-olds, and working with those young horses and bringing them along. You've had a lot of success doing that. Do you think that's why? Because you're able to pick up on things within the actual horse himself that aren't just what you see physically, but kind of that want-to that you just described?
I do, yes. I've become to believe that is the case. I don't know that I have much other talents in the world, but I do believe that the good Lord gave me an ability to read livestock and see things maybe a little sooner than the average person, along with life experiences.
When you start working with those young horses, how long does it take you to figure out if that horse has the desire and the heart and the want to be a good racehorse?
The very best ones, the ones that are really, I know, like, he is a natural. He's going to compete. He's going to play ball. And that's, you know, maybe 5%. I'll see those right away. And then the very lowest end, like, he's not going to compete. He's not going to try hard. Those two, 5% on the top, 5% on the bottom, I don't know that it takes me more than a few weeks, maximum. Within the first month, the really best ones. Now, that's the best competitor. I have no idea what his physical talent is, his physical ability, foot speed and all that, stamina. But just that guy that's going to go play ball and show up, with his tennis shoes laced up tight and already stretched before practice and like, hey, let's play ball. Those kind, show you pretty early. And then, like I said, the others that show you they have zero desire to be nothing, they show you pretty early. And then all the rest are kind of hard to discern.
Do you remember a story of a horse that...
Those take months. So those take months before you figure out if they're going to try or not.
Yeah, that's interesting. Do you remember a story, Danny, of a horse that maybe fooled you, where you thought, okay, this horse doesn't really show that competitive fight, and then all of a sudden, when you start working with them, the switch goes on, and they just become really, really good?
Horses that I get that have been started by other people, other colt breakers, not to say that other people, there's lots of good horsemen in this world. Lots of people can start a colt in good fashion. However, if I start them through my techniques that I do from day one in the round pen, not so much. I don't get fooled too often. But horses that have had hands on them quite a bit at other locations, that horse can take me a lot longer and I can be really fooled by those sometimes. Sometimes I'll think that they're really good and they're not that good. Sometimes I'll think they're not much and then they'll turn out being even more. But when I get fooled, it's pretty much 100% someone else's thumbprint had been on the horse, and so I was misreading what I was seeing.
You know, Danny, I was just thinking as you were talking there, we were talking about the rodeo and some of the things that you took away, and you gave a great explanation of the things you took away from working with horses and livestock for all those years and now working with thoroughbreds. And as somebody who has been married for more than 20 years, I'm going to put this on a tee for you and let you knock it out of the park. I would imagine if I ask you what the most special thing that you took away from the rodeo was, it's going to be your wife, Sabina. Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, without question.
Because I know if she listens to this, I want to make sure I get that covered for you.
Well, and it's not no fluff. That's a great woman that has she stuck it out with me and saw things through and showed me how to be a little kinder and a little more attuned to everyone else's feelings, including my horses.
And I say that because you met at the rodeo, right?
Yes. Yeah, when we met, actually, we had traveled in a lot of the same circles around a lot of the same. I had competed at rodeos that her father was a stock contractor at several times. But somehow we hadn't crossed paths. And so then when we met each other, we're like, well, how in the world could we be strangers? We know all the same people, But yeah, that's where I met her.
Yeah, and I guess the apple doesn't fall far from the tree when you think about it, because you also have a son, Joe Dan, who has already done pretty well with getting some buckles on the junior rodeo competitions too.
Yeah, yes, he has, and he's currently lost interest in the equine world, but he's certainly an individual in his own right, and he can come back. He's certainly got a foundation that if he ever decides to return to the equine world in any type of discipline, I think he's got enough foundation to do that. But lately he's kind of gone his own route, but I'm proud of him for that. He wants to be his own man and do his own thing.
What if he comes to you one day and says, Dad, I want to follow in your footsteps. I want to be a bull rider. What do you tell him?
Well, thank goodness I have a very logical thing that I can tell him that and he knows is true. When he was younger, I might have been foolish enough, and I was younger, I might have been foolish enough to be encouraged to see him do it. But now I can tell him the truth, which is, son, I was fairly big for a bull rider. You're even bigger than me. How about you try bulldogging instead of bulldogging, and I've actually told him that before. I said, if you get interested, because he rode some calves and stuff when he was a kid, and I told him then, I said, looks like, bulldogging would be more appropriate, because he's about 2 inches taller than me and about the same weight.
Talking with trainer Danny Pish here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. As you heard, if you're just joining us, he started his career in rodeo as a bull rider and had a lot of success there, and now is having a tremendous amount of success training thoroughbreds as well. When you first started getting into working with horses, Danny, racehorses anyway, you worked with a gentleman by the name of Tommy Oliphant, and he was just a legend in his own right. He passed away in 2014 at the age of 88, but somebody who was a Hall of Famer in Texas and really highly regarded. Tell me about working with Tommy.
Well, what I learned from Tommy was twofold or two-facet as far as he really told me taught me a lot about the thoroughbred industry in general and how to prepare a young thoroughbred horse and to get ready to go to the races and do his job. And he just ran his barn and ran his life in such a fashion that, he really helped me get focused. When I decided to put the thoroughbred racehorses on the front of the burner and the rodeo on the back burner, I really went to the right place because the good Lord, I felt like, gave me a chance at a second dream job. I mean, the rodeo deal was a dream job, and I didn't take that real serious. I wasn't very businesslike. I was haphazard in my planning and my training and just didn't take it as serious as a guy should have. And so Mr. Oliphant, on the other hand, he could work all day in a white shirt and never get dirty, for starters. And he had notes on everything important. You could never catch him unprepared about anything. And so the way he ran the barn, ran the grooms, the way he did his billing, the way he did his collection, the way he did everything was just an absolute wonderful example. So it was a wonderful horseman that taught me how to train horses. He taught me how to run a barn. He taught me how to be a good man. And so, yeah, I really owe that guy.
Earlier you said that you consider yourself a horseman, and I've said for many, many years there are horsemen and there are trainers, and there's a big difference between the two. Would you say that Tommy was also a horseman?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, and a war hero, too, by the way. I was looking up his – I actually found his obituary online, believe it or not, and I started reading it as I was getting ready for the show. And at 18, he joined the Marine Corps during World War II, served in the Pacific Islands, and was eventually wounded in Iwo Jima, which is what brought him back home to start getting involved with training horses. His story is just remarkable.
Yeah, no, he's an all-American guy, that's for sure. All-American guy, and that story is really incredible. And that arm that was injured in Iwo Jima, they told him he'd probably never straighten it out again, and he actually straightened that arm out on a muck fork, mucking stalls, and got that elbow straightened out.
No, I did not realize that. Oh, wow. Well, what a great part of that story, and it's all part of the story of Danny Pish as well, who is my special guest here on Trainer Talk today. Danny, people will describe you as being easygoing and laid back. Is that fair?
Yes, it's fair. I would say there would be a lot of people that would counter that, though, the wife and my employees and whatnot. If I feel all I's are dotted and all T's are crossed, I'm easygoing and laid back. But if I myself or some part of my team, I feel like failed to dot an I across a T, I'm not too easy going or laid back.
I mentioned at the top of the show that you are a native of Texas, born and raised, and you have decided to be loyal to Texas racing, even though there have been several challenges that racing in the state has faced over the years. Why did you decide to make sure that you were always loyal to Texas?
You know, I've been credited for that, and actually it has been a few times where it just fell in my lap as the right thing to do. You know, I'm a very proud Texan, and enough to probably offend anyone else from another state if you really delve into that, you know, because I'm very proud South Texas native. You know, I'll throw that in there, you know, South Texas boy. But, you know, at the same time, there were circumstances, just like in everybody's life, where things just, you know, you just pointed in a certain direction. And there was a number of times when I was really like, you know what, I'm gonna, you know, go to another state and really concentrate on something else. And then I would pick up a Texas-based client, you know, a significant Texas-based client. And then two or three other Texas-based people were new and just getting in the game, and they would come to me. And so each time that I began to make plans to try to concentrate on another circuit, things would come in, you know, and I was making a living, and the opportunity to continue to make that living seemed to be obtainable there in front of me. And so it was more happenstance and circumstances that kept me here than outright. You know, I'd say that my loyalty kept me here maybe longer than I should, which allowed those possibilities to fall in my lap. But then once those possibilities did, I said, well, okay, I'm going to stay put.
You know, as a Texas guy and as somebody who said you wanted to play football when you grew up and try to be a professional football player, is it Houston Texans, Dallas Cowboys? Who is it for you?
Dallas Cowboys, in spite of recent – yeah, I'm a Cowboys fan. And like I said, Walt Garrison was my hero. I thought that's got to be the coolest guy ever because he's a Dallas Cowboy and he's a professional rodeo cowboy. And so I thought he was, you know, pretty cool life to live.
Yeah, well, just tremendous stuff. And Danny Pish is my special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Going to go ahead and get to a short commercial break. When I come back, we'll spend some time talking about his favorite memories from his training career, some of the trips to the Breeders' Cup, and then we'll talk about some of the horses that have touched him over the years as well, including a Texas Horse of the Year. Stay with me. It's Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Mid-Atlantic Fall Yearlings. Over 550 cataloged with over 150 New York breds. Ranked among the top yearling sales in North America by Grade 1 and Graded Stakes winners sold. Recent grads include Captain Scotty, Field Pass, Project Whiskey, and Pumpkin Rumble. The Phasic Tipton Mid-Atlantic Fall Yearling Sale, Monday and Tuesday, October 5th and 6th, after the Preakness in Timonium, Maryland. Where will you be?
In 1993, Dr. John West showed that EIPH occurs during exercise when blood vessels in the lungs rupture. This is due to stress caused by high blood pressure on the inside of the vessels and strong suction forces on the outside. Only flare strips and Lasix, used together or alone, have been clinically proven to reduce EIPH. Lasix works by reducing the high internal pressures, and flare strips work by reducing the suction forces on the outside. See the science at flarestrips.com.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
And Got Shades is honing in too. Wide off the turns, My Smooth Talker and My K-Sara is at the back. They're at the quarter pole. Smiling Phil, Ponta Talk, these two shoulder to shoulder off the turn. On the outside, Thunder Run, Got Shade swings wide. Mighty Brown is stymied in behind horses, trying to get on track, furlong to go. And Got Shades takes over. Got Shades the leader, down to the final 16th. Thunder Run gives way. Mighty Brown, a final try in the final 50 yards. Got Shades trying to hold, and Got Shades does. 3/4 of a length over Mighty Brown second, Thunder Run was third, and My Case Era fourth.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you as always. If you missed any portion of the show, my visit with trainer Danny Pish, which will continue momentarily, all you have to do is head back over to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows. You can listen, binge listen to Trainer Talk if you want to, at your leisure, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts, another way to access the programs. You can also follow us on social media at HRRN on Twitter and Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook and Instagram. Well, that call from Travis Stone that you just heard, that goes back a ways. That was a young Travis Stone, currently the announcer at Churchill Downs. That was back in 2013 at Louisiana Downs. Got Shades getting the victory in the Sunday Silence Stakes. It was a race that would ultimately catapult him to a start in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf that year at Santa Anita. And, of course, Got Shades trained by my special guest tonight, Danny Pish. Look, Danny, we'll start there with Got Shades. What a talented runner. And I know that he ran very, very well in the Breeders' Cup, didn't win. He was fifth that year behind a horse called Outstrip, but ran a good race for you at Santa Anita.
Yes, I was proud. He went out there and ran his race and actually had a little traffic trouble. We really could have maybe scared him up there. You know, I think that he could have finished considerably better with a smooth trip, because we got stopped going in the second turn, and these things happen in racing, and he re-rallied to be fifth. I don't think he's worse than second with a good trip, though.
You know, we were out there, too. We broadcast that Breeders' Cup on national radio here on the network. And I can remember our first one in 2007 at Monmouth, and what a tremendous experience it was. We've been broadcasting the Breeders' Cup on radio ever since. How about for you, that first experience of going to the Breeders' Cup for the first time, going out to Santa Anita, what was that like for you? What do you remember about it?
Oh, very enjoyable. I really enjoyed that trip out there, because it just... You know, it's the Breeders' Cup, you know, and I mean, they do everything right, first class, and it's the world championship of thoroughbred horse racing. And so it's, you know, and I had, watched it a bunch on television, but, hadn't attended one. I say that alongside attended the Lone Star Park Breeders' Cup, but that was, just to watch the races. But to have a competitor in the thoroughbred world championship was just exciting to be there. And then Santa Anita, you know, what a place. What history. So much history and a great race place.
How cool is it to walk into the paddock before the race, leading Got Shades in there, and you look around and there's Chad Brown and Todd Pletcher and Doug O'Neill and Wayne Lucas, Aiden O'Brien. How cool is that for you to walk in there and see all those big names standing next to you?
Oh, it was really cool and really humbling, you know, to be in their presence, because the accomplishments and the outstanding horse flesh they've been around and just the things they've done in the game, you know, it was humbling and also satisfying at the same time, thinking, well, okay, if I get the right stock, I think just at this level, just takes the right stock.
Yeah, and in the first half of the show, we talked about the fact that after working with bucking stock for so long, that it's helped you when you now transition to working with the racing stock. That comparison, how do you quantify that comparison and why it's actually helped you?
Well, the bucking stock in particular, I mean, all the experience with the various disciplines of horsemanship, with the rope horses and ranch horses and stuff, that all helps. But the bucking stock angle, one thing that when I began to realize that there was a pretty strong comparison to the two was an undefeated young runner that gets headed and approaching the eighth pole and battles hard, but then gives in, and then two or three more go by before they get to the wire. Sometimes when that happens to a young undefeated horse, they don't win again for quite some time. And it's not that they lost their foot speed. It's not that they lost their stamina. It's just that they now realize they can be beat. And so seeing that and seeing a high percentage of young horses that go 2 for 2, 3 for 3, and then the first time they get beat, man, some of them never return to that form, and others takes a long time to get back to it. And then the largest category get back to that winning form, but they do it at a lower level, not the level that was anticipated they might be at. And so seeing that in the racehorses, and then knowing so many times with bucking stock, you have an unridden bull, and whether it be a short unridden career, 10 or 12, 15, whatever, or 100 times of never being ridden, whatever the case may be, a large percentage of the bucking stock that goes unridden, and then they get ridden, some of them actually throw in the towel and just quit bucking. They don't even buck anymore. They might make one or two bucks out of shooting, and then they might stop and stand still. They're done with it. But this is the same animal that was unridden for 30, 40, 50 trips. And sometimes it happens in the exact ride. Like I've seen bucking stock that never got rode past their sixth jump, their fifth or sixth jump or whatever. Well, then a guy makes it past that real tricky jump. By jump 7, he slows down. By jump 8, he is stopped, standing still. And so that can happen in the bucking stock world. Well, like I said, an undefeated horse that just goes to the front. And if he's undefeated and he laid mid-pack, battled his way up there and come on, he's not that likely to get discouraged. But if he manhandles the field 3 races in a row, just skips out of the gates, inherits the lead, boy rates him a little bit, the field comes to him, he re-breaks, draws clear. That horse do that about 3 times in a row, and then in his 4th race, there's a horse coming to him, and that horse's nose gets past his hip. He gets past this undefeated horse's hip with his nose, and then he gets to the rider's foot with his nose. I am going to be a nervous wreck if that's my horse that's on the lead and been on the lead, because many of them do not respond to that well. They like to manhandle the situation, dominate, and when they can't, they get discouraged. They don't want to play ball no more. And so that is a very much mirror image, consistent with the rodeo bucking stock and racehorses.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's fascinating. I think we could even say it's a lot like, let's stick with the NFL theme since we were talking about football earlier, but you get a team, maybe not even so much an NFL team, but maybe a college team that goes out and dominates the competition. All of a sudden, they get into a game in the 4th quarter, and they're down to a 1-score game, and the whole picture changes. Your approach, your mentality, the nerves are amped up a bit, and they may not perform the way that they performed when they were dominating the competition in the previous games.
Quite often don't. It's just the truth of it. Quite often don't, because their confidence is rattled. You didn't think there was no way they could be more confident. It wouldn't be possible. But then, their confidence has been rattled and shaken. And there's those ones that have it, and they respond correctly. If not that day, they come back and respond correctly soon thereafter. But there's a lot of them that just never are the same after that.
You've used a term a couple of times now during the program so far that I don't know if I've ever heard a trainer use on this show or in any interview that I've done, Danny, and that's foot speed. We usually think about professional athletes, human athletes, having good foot speed, and that's what makes them so successful in a lot of respects. But horses also have to have good foot speed?
Well, yeah, no question. It's a high cruising speed is one thing, but when I speak of foot speed, what I have in my mind is that ability to quicken at the end of the race, or the ability to quicken right out of the starting gates, when they can really amp up that foot speed, because the stride is going to be pretty much the stride. But if they can, pick them down and, lay them down and pick them up just a little quicker, then it just allows them to run a more efficient race.
Talking with trainer Danny Pish here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. He has trained more than 2,400 winners, fast approaching the 2,500 win milestone. His runners have earned nearly $38 million in purses, and he continues to click along at a very high level. Danny, you're starting now. We talked about that first Breeders' Cup. You went back to the Breeders' Cup again years later. You were on the fringe of going back to the Breeders' Cup this year and not going to make it, but all of a sudden, we're starting to talk about Danny Pish not as a claiming trainer or an allowance trainer. You're starting to get some horses that are competing in big stakes races, too. How come?
Oh, you know, that's hard to put my finger on. A little bit of it is easy to put my finger on. I have never really been able to go to the sale and really buy the type of horses that I wanted to buy. I've had a wonderful group of clients that have been great to me, but they haven't been the guys that'll pay $200,000-$400,000 for a yearling. In recent years, I've had RTL Racing, Red Lane Thoroughbred, has spent a little more money, and that's an interesting story there too. The guy that's buying the horses for them is a guy that kind of stumbled into the game. I kind of got him in the game. And with RTL letting us spend a little more money and with Frank having a real good discerning eye and buying some better individuals, that's got me to where I've been on the radar screen and won a few stakes races at a little higher level and placed in a few others. And so that's helped. And then also, I mean, there's always just luck, just getting good individuals. I've been lucky into a few homebreds that could really run recently, as well as some others that weren't really high-dollar purchases, but they came through the sales, and they were some more that my man Frank picked out for me. So sure proud of that guy.
Let's talk about the horse sales, Danny. When we hear a horse checks all the right boxes, we hear that a lot when people go to the sales, or ticks all the boxes, checks all the boxes, however you want to say it. What are some of the boxes that when you and your team start looking at horses at the sales, what are some of the boxes that they have to check for you before you raise your hand to bid?
Oh, that's hard to say exactly. I mean, it's all the standard stuff, the confirmation and a big sweeping walk. And when I say confirmation, I mean confirmation. We analyze. When I go to the sale, I'm looking from his ears to his tail and back and again. I mean, the position of the tail, does it tie in high? Does it tie in low? You know, the length, you know, just the overall appearance of the horse. Does he carry himself with a little swagger? Does he carry himself with too much swagger? You know, and so between confirmation and the way they walk, the way they react to the handler, I mean, you name it. I'm looking at him and dissecting from his, like I said, from his bottom of his feet to the top of the pole of his head.
What does his tail have to do with anything?
Well, actually, it's balance. It's balance. Where their tail begins to come out of their body, if it looks like it's coming out way up high on his back, that horse, probably run all day, but not that fast. If it looks like it's coming out real low down there between his butt cheeks there, that horse probably real fast and can't get past a half a mile. And so you want that tail position just so, not too high, not too low.
Well, again, that's something I've never had a trainer talk about on this program. Just interesting stuff with trainer Danny Pish here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton here on HRN. Danny, let's talk about some of the horses that you've been around that have always captured your mind or you're never going to forget. One of those I would imagine has to be Leaving on My Mind, who was honored as the Texas Thoroughbred Association's 2004 Horse of the Year. Tell me about Leaving on My Mind.
Oh man, what a nice individual he was. He improved through training and racing. I often say that, you know, we don't just need the good one. We need the good one that will improve through a campaign. And he did just that. He was kind of a high energy, a little bit difficult to train. You know, kind of wanted to do too much in the morning, but he was also manageable. If you just kept, you know, a close eye on him and a tight rein on him, you could keep him from doing too much. And just had a desire to play the game and love to go train as well, and just continued to improve. And after his last victory of his career, really bad luck deal, he came down with EPM. And never was the same after that. And he likely was. I've never had a $1 million earner with all the things I've done. Never won a graded stakes race. I think I've won probably 150 different stakes races, and had some nice horses. Had lots of $500,000 earners and whatnot. But I've never had a $1 million earner. That guy would have been easy if he wouldn't have got EPM. He was the real deal.
Yeah, you tried to bring him back. That was in 2005, by the way, after he won. His last win came in the Richard King Handicap at Sam Houston in November of 2005. He then went on to finish second in the Conroe Stakes at the end of the year. And then he was off until February of 2007. So you had about a year and a half or so before you brought him back. What was the thinking on trying to get him back? What was he showing you that led you to believe he could be successful?
The physical rehabilitation, appeared to be complete, looking at his body. EPM causes atrophy and whatnot, and it's, you know, pretty telltale signs when you see one. And, you know, the atrophy had gone away. His hips had filled back in. His coordination was there. His breathing was there. So his nervous system rebounded nicely when you do the measurables. But I guess maybe there was still something that wasn't, you know, just the full strength was not there, because when we did the measurables, passed all the tests, everything looked good, looked like 100% recovery. But when it came down to getting back to the races, he just didn't have it any longer. And I really think he was just missing a little physical toughness, a little physical strength that he once had that he just no longer had.
When you mention some of the $500,000 earners that you've had the privilege to train, one of those, matter of fact, the horse that's probably earned the most money of any horse you've trained was a horse by the name of Goosey Moose, who was another Texas bred, earned $587,000 after winning 11 of 59 starts, and was second and third a whole bunch of times too. You talk about an old school hickory horse. Tell me about Goosey Moose.
Goosey Moose was a physical, unbelievable physical talented horse. It's my belief that Goosey Moose wasn't that interested in racing. He just did it because we asked him to. He didn't dislike it, but he wasn't in love with it like Leaving on My Mind was. But he had some physical ability. My goodness, that horse, and just was able to do all that stuff and stay running. And he's now a accomplished 3-day eventing horse, because I kept him around after his career and rode him some and kind of got him reacclimated to different styles of being ridden. And he's now a pretty accomplished 3-day event horse.
Wow, what a great story. Yeah, he again, $576,000 in career earnings, and a horse that just always showed up almost every time you put a saddle on him. Who are some of the other horses, Danny, when you think back on your career, that are always going to stand out to you for whatever reason?
Well, a horse named Boots on Sunday is one that comes to mind the most, because he, too, made right at the $500,000 mark, was raised at the same ranch as Goosey Moose. But Wilton Scott, a fine gentleman that had raised some pretty nice Texas breeds. Boots on Sunday, to me, what you talk about desire. Oh, my goodness. I used to tell people that Boots on Sunday was cheap speed that refused to admit it. He just refused to admit it. I mean, because He didn't. He showed the foot speed, but he didn't show much stamina at all when I first started breaking him and getting him ready. And he was also a horse that would lose his fitness quicker than any horse I ever trained. A lot of them, you get them to a certain point, and it's management. You're just managing them along. You're not all that concerned about fitness. You're more concerned about composure. Mental composure trumps fitness quite often in this game. You need a mentally composed athlete walking over there, and he can use whatever fitness he has to the full extent if he's composed. If he's not composed, he may appear to be not that fit, but it really wasn't his physical fitness. It was his lack of keeping it all together causing the tire. But Boots never had nothing but composure nearly. I mean, very rarely did he lose his composure, but you had to ask him to do more. You had to ask him to do more regularly. And when you did, he responded. And he was one, you know, talk about old school hickory horse. I mean, he had like a 4-year career. He never, he showed up 5 out of 6 races for 4 years straight. And we ran him just about every time the band played. I mean, it's not like we spaced his races out a bunch. This horse competed regularly, and he just loved it.
And you know, we talked in the first.
You know,
go ahead, Danny.
So many aggravating generals. Another one on those lines. It was a Texas bred, and he had like a 4-year campaign where he didn't hardly ever run a bad race in 4 years, and his career was really incredible.
You know, we talked in the first half of the show about your love of Texas, being a Texas guy and supporting Texas racing. You've had so much success. You look at the multiple trainer titles at Sam Houston and Lone Star and, 15 at Retama, I guess. I mean, you have really just dominated racing in that part of the country for a long time. How do you know, like, for example, a horse that you were just talking about, goes out of town, a horse like Boots on Sunday. He has a lot of success in Texas, and then the time comes to take a shot somewhere else. And you brought him up to Laurel for the Grade 1 DeFrancis Memorial Dash in 2001. How do you know that horse is ready to maybe take that next step, or that you feel he deserves a shot at something bigger? How do you know?
You know, for me, it's a lot of stuff. I go back to what I really thought of him when I started him. And so that really has a strong play on him. What did I really think of this horse when I first started him? Did I think he might achieve that level someday? Because I don't want to fool myself. And so I look at that, and then I look at consistent performance with gradual improvement of numbers. I still go by buyer speed figures. I know there's lots of different ways to analyze a horse's performance nowadays, but I'm still a guy that just look at buyers. And if I see consistent, gradually improving buyers, 2 to 3 points, I don't want to see a big jump. But if I see this horse and he's just competing very well, and he runs at 80, and then he runs at 83, and then he runs at 85, hey, it's about time we better, if we're going to take a look now, right now, let's take a look, because that's genuine improvement. When you see those 5 and 10 number jumps, 15 number jumps, whatever, those are rarely legitimate. That's just a horse that just freaked one day, and he had a Clint Longley Thanksgiving Day kind of deal, but that really wasn't who he was, you know. And so I like to see consistent performance with gradually improving numbers, as well as I want to remember, did I really think he was all that at one time? Did I think he had the ability to be that? Because sometimes, you know, a cheap horse will get good, but a cheap horse won't stay good. And so I have to try to discern, okay, is this a cheap horse that's just got good, and so should we stay local? Or is this a horse that's really something above, you know, the everyday? And Boots definitely was. And that's one thing that, although the DeFrancis Memorial Dash there, we didn't fare that well that day. He actually bled that day, which he wasn't a chronic bleeder, but he did bleed that day for some reason. But some of his other, when we went to Hot Springs against those open company horses, and, you know, there were several times when you know, he would show up and get that third, you know, he'd be part of the trifecta or whatever. And it would often be in groups where his numbers were just under. His numbers were not really what they should have been, but yet he would show up anyway. And I was as proud of him on those days as I was the time that he, the many times he won the Texas Bred Stakes races and set track record and stuff like that. I was equally as proud of some of those thirds because they were in deep fields. They were against some deep competition.
Well, Danny, we're coming into the final furlong of this Trainer Talk show, down to about the final 2.5 minutes or so, and I always like to wrap up the program by asking trainers to tell us something that maybe we haven't talked about yet, something about yourself that people might not know. So other hobbies, interests, things you enjoy, even outside of horse racing. What might a couple of those things be, Danny?
Well, this is going to be hard to stumble fill 2.5 minutes because I'm a very boring guy. I know the rodeo world. I know the racehorse world. I occasionally catch an NFL game. And man, you know, that's really who I am. I mean, I credit the good Lord's gifts for me to have any success that I have. And, you know, it's just pretty plain, straightforward guy.
Will you still go attend events like the National Finals Rodeo?
Yes, yes, I do. And this year it's in Texas, so I'm definitely going to. But I go to Vegas about every other year because I really still enjoy. And I occasionally still rope when, you know, my. It's ironic that, you know, people say, well, you spend your whole life horseback, and when you're going to do something away from that, you go team rope. I mean, I'm like, well, it's what I know. It's what I enjoy. So, but yes, I definitely am going to go to the National Finals this year, and I go quite often.
One of the things that's definitely on my bucket list, I have to make it to an NFR event one year, maybe in Vegas or when we get back to normal, who knows where, but have to do it. And Danny, we'll look forward to catching up with you when we make it there or at a racetrack very, very soon. Listen, appreciate the visit, my friend. It's been fantastic to hear your story. All the best moving forward, and good luck with the whole barn and with everything you got going on.
Thank you so much, Mike. You have a good one.
All right, Danny Pish here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Again, fantastic story. The backstory the past couple of weeks with these trainers have just been incredible. And my thanks to Danny for taking time to do it. If you missed any portion of the show, go to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast at your leisure. You can also do it at Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts. Now for my producer, Lee Delapina, in our Lexington studio, for trainer Danny Pish, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.
I'll get you some good tickets.
Danny, you still there?
Yeah.
Hey, thank you so much.